Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back to the Mindful Hunter podcast. I'm your host, as always, Jay Nicol. And today, we are going to get into my gear list for the sheep hunt that I recently got back from. And we're going to go through it bit by bit. I'm going to tell you what worked, what didn't, all that good stuff. Before we do that, a little bit of housekeeping. Reminder, if you enjoy nerding out on gear, if you want unbiased, non-sponsored gear reviews, and you want to participate in selecting the gear that gets reviewed, join in on raffles for that gear when I raffle it off, and just generally participate in a community of like-minded individuals who are just trying to get better at hunting and not waste their money on garbage gear, mindful-reviews.com. Currently have 226 members. Community's growing all the time, and we would love to have you over there. Also, quick update about my September hunt. So I was originally supposed to go on a fly-in caribou goat hunt, and my partner had some health issues, some like physical health issues with his hip, and so had to pull out. So instead of trying to force that trip, what I've done instead is I'm just going to pull an audible and I'm going to go on a completely different trip. I was going to fly in by myself and it just doesn't make any sense to do that. So what I'm actually going to do is go elk hunting solo for 10 days. So if you're going to be elk hunting this year, I want to hear from you. I'm trying to cover as much elk content as possible over the next month. So I'm going to be doing interviews with people, going to be doing my gear list. And I want to hear from everybody who's going elk hunting. Also, I'm hoping to do a bit of an elk hunting tour. I'm going to have my truck, my quad. I'm sleeping in the back of the truck. I got a few different areas I'm going to check out, but let me know where you're hunting, and who knows, maybe I'll be in the neighborhood and we can link up for a day or something like that. That would be super cool. Even if I'm fortunate enough to take out a bull early, I'd love to pop around and maybe get a day in hunting with some people, do some call in and just basically, yeah, enjoy the elk woods, because it's probably, I don't know, if you put a gun to my head and said you can only do one type of hunting for the rest of your life, I would probably pick archery elk in the rut. And yes, I will be taking my bow, even though it's rifle season. I don't give a shit. It's how I like hunting elk. So that's what I'm going to do. So yeah, get in touch. Let me know what your plans are. My main area of concern where I'm going to be heading first is the Peace. If I'm unable to turn something up there, maybe I'll head over to another area. You know, I've always been curious about the Kootenays. I've never done any hunting whatsoever in the Kootenays. In fact, the Kootenays is probably the only part of this province that I've never been to. Due to forestry and hunting, I've spent a pretty large amount of time in most of the other corners of the province, but never been to the Kootenays. So maybe let me know if you've got some plans out there. I just love to hear what it's like out there, and maybe if not elk season, what would be another, you know, season that you would recommend heading out to the Kootenays, for a hunt? That would be, and it's maybe keeping in mind that, you know, I don't have much experience out there and I don't have any spots. So something that's got, you know, a little bit easier to get into maybe, but yeah, would love to hear from you in that regards, and good luck everybody who's going to be elk hunting this year. All right, let's talk about the hunt a little bit. I am currently working on the hunt film. It should be released early next week. So I don't want to do a complete forensic recap of the hunt, because you're going to get all that through the hunt film. However, I think in order to put the gear breakdown in context, it's good to have a kind of overview of how the hunt went, what the weather was like, and all that kind of stuff. So we did do a hike in off the highway hunt this year. It was an archery sheep hunt. I had a partner with me. His name's Chad. He was 55. He was in decent shape. Had some knee issues. So there's a little bit of complications there, but got to give it to the guy. Tons of heart, tons of grit, never quit, never whined. So that was, yeah, it was part of the hunt, and good on him for being as tough as he was. But it wasn't like mission critical. Like, there was nothing, we were never worried that he was going to have to lift it out. It was more just like, you know, some breaks while hunting and that kind of stuff. I mean, hiking, some breaks while hiking and that kind of stuff. But overall, not a big deal. But I don't hunt with people very often, and I liked it. It was definitely different. I'm used to being by myself. I think, and this is kind of like a bit of a digression, but I tend to make better films when I'm by myself, I feel like. Or at least when I get home, they feel more robust. And I was trying to explain it to my wife last night that when you're by yourself, you end up capturing all of the decision-making process because there's nobody else to talk to. So you end up talking to the camera because it just feels more natural that as you're kind of working things out and deciding where to go and deciding what to do, because you're doing it in your head anyways, you might as well do it with the camera on. But when you're with somebody, you tend to do all that stuff together. And it feels weird to turn a camera on and point it at the two of you while you're having a natural conversation. Now, there are people like The Hunting Public, Born and Raised Outdoors. These guys are naturally group-based hunters. They're all used to being on camera, and they capture that kind of like group hunting experience very well. That's not my forte. My forte is just being by myself and kind of capturing it through my perspective. So that was a note to myself that I want to work on a little bit more. I'm still very happy with the footage I got. I still think it's going to be a great film, but I definitely noticed a difference in almost like the depth of content or how much, you know, background information I captured compared to when I'm by myself. Also, when you're by yourself, there's nothing else to do. So you turn the camera on and record shit and film shit and do shit to kind of like, you know, take up the day. Whereas when you've got a hunting partner, you're sitting around, you're bullshitting, you're laughing. And that was the thing. We had a ton of fun. I definitely laughed more on this hunt than I did on any other hunt that I was by myself. So there's point number, well, a couple points. It was a hike-in hunt, it was an archery hunt, and I had a hunting partner. Now, weather, it was almost the tale of two hunts. The first half of the hunt was sunny. We ended up turning up lots of sheep, and there wasn't very many people. The second half of the hunt, wolves came in, rain came in, pressure, like people came in, and the sheep took off. So it was a, overall, it was a fantastic hunt. I saw more sheep than I've ever seen. I got sub 100 yards twice on mature rams. It wasn't like I screwed up a stock or anything. It was like the stock never even really took place. The rams were on the move. We were kind of positioned. They kind of caught us, didn't catch us off guard, but we never really had a chance to get set up. And then before you know it, the rams were gone. So it was like, it was cool to be that close. But I think the next step for me is being able to have like a real, you know, stock and shot opportunity, because that didn't really happen on this trip. As far as my physical fitness, hands down, this was the best hunt I have had in recent memory. Like, probably since my elk hunt in 2019, which was the last hunt I did before I started getting ready for my bodybuilding show. I spent almost 4 years getting ready for that show. And since that elk hunt in 2019, I've always been, I think, over 260 for all my hunts. And I showed up for this hunt at 238 pounds, came out at 228 pounds. So I lost 10 pounds on this hunt. It was pretty aggressive. We did lots of hiking. I took quite a bit of food. I'll get into that later on. So I don't think there was any way to really, being a guy of that size, I mean, that most of that is just water weight. I've only put on 1 pound since I got back though. So that's, satisfying is not the word I'm looking for. It's encouraging because, you know, maybe I did shave some real weight while I was out there, but I felt phenomenal. No knee issues, no back issues. Boots felt great. Like I didn't have any, no hot spots, no blisters. Like it just felt like I could hike and hike and hike. Normally I feel like it takes 3 days until you hit your stride hunting. And this trip, it was like right out of the gate on the hike in, I was like, let's go. So that was really rewarding because it just felt, man, I can grind through a hunt. I can put my head down. I can be, you know, too heavy and have knee problems and all the rest of it. And get through it, but it's like every day you wake up and you're looking, towards those kind of grinder hikes, it weighs on your mind and it's not nearly as enjoyable of an experience. Whereas this one, I never had that sense of dread about any of the hikes. Like, we're going to move camp, no problem. Let's throw it on our back and get out of here. It was great in that regard. Now, the other note that helped there is this is the lightest pack I've ever gone in with by a mile. So final weight on the pack with everything except bow and water was 65.8 pounds. That includes camera gear. That includes 12 days worth of food. That includes everything. That would be the other note. The hunt was, we spent 12 days hunting on this trip. And that can be challenging, taking in that much food, averaging 2 pounds a day. I mean, normally you do a 10-day hunt. Some people count their hike in and hike out days. They might only be taking 8 or 9 pounds of food, which could be as low as, 16 pounds. Sorry, 8 or 9 days of food, which could be as low as 16 pounds. And 12 days of food with all the packaging, turned out to be 24 pounds. So that's another 5 or 6 pounds that was in there. But 66 pounds, 65.8 technically, was my final pack weight. So between having my physical fitness in check and having, adding on that decent pack weight really, really sealed the deal on feeling extremely competent getting around the mountains this trip. All right, with all that out of the way, let's dive into the gear list. So the last thing I think I'll take a moment to talk about is people and pressure. So, because it kind of makes you think about the type of hunts you want moving forward. This was definitely the most people I've ever run into on a sheep hunt, for sure. Also the most sheep I've ever run into on a sheep hunt. So it kind of begs the question, do you go places where there are lots of sheep and people know there are lots of sheep where you're going to run into people? Or do you go to places that might not have as many sheep, but probably won't have as many people? Now, none of those things are ever guarantees. You could go to a place where you think there's sheep and there's no sheep and there's still tons of people. And you could go to a sheep where, or you could go to a place where people think there's lots of sheep and nobody shows up and you've got the place to yourself and there's sheep everywhere. But that being said, there's normally this kind of 2x2 matrix of sheep presence along the x-axis and people presence along the y-axis. And you got high and low for both. And normally when known sheep presence becomes high, known people presence becomes high. And the same is true for when they both become low. And it made me think that, I'll be honest with you, I would prefer lower sheep populations with lower pressure. For what I'm looking for in a sheep hunt, don't get me wrong, I want to kill a sheep. But specifically with sheep, I'm looking for that intense remote experience where I feel like I'm finding a new corner of the map. And I'm really out there on my own, discovering something and having a good time. And if that means less sheep, especially after this hunt, it made me realize I'm okay with that. I don't mind that. So that was a bit challenging. I think we saw overall the 12 days, 21 people, which, is a bit of a kick in the nuts. Now, here's one last point I'll make before we get into the gear list. I want to have a talk about hunter etiquette, and I'd love some feedback from you guys. So overall, the people that we ran into, or at least saw from a distance, all the engagements were very respectful. Like, I remember one night we got to this section, we saw these rams, we're about to make a play, and then we spot these two guys up on a hill. And it was maybe 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And me and Chad were having a talk about it. And these rams were kind of like moving off of one hill and onto another hill. But it wasn't clear whether those guys were going to keep chasing them or not. And we weren't sure where they were camped. And there was limited area to hunt. But basically, we came to the conclusion that for that day, they'd got there first. We were going to stay off the hill. We were going to sit in camp and just glass, figure out a game plan tomorrow. But we also agreed that tomorrow's a new day. There was definitely people in there, and we can't give up whole mountains to people and just stay out of them because, you know, you still have to hunt. And I kind of think like a new day is a new day. But when you show up and somebody's on a hill, in my mind, that's your hill for the day. If I get up before you tomorrow, maybe that's my hill tomorrow, but that's another battle for another day. And we stayed off the hill. And those guys came down off the hill. They walked to their camp, which actually wasn't too far. So the next day, they packed up and they left. And we kind of had the hill to ourselves for a day or two. Now, funny enough, yeah, 2, maybe 3 days later, we're on the exact same hill. I'm sitting on some sheep. It was just lambs and ewes, but there was a high probability of some rams kind of coming over the back and down to these lambs and ewes because it had happened before on a previous day. And we're kind of sitting in this, I don't know if you'd call it like a little ditch or a little swale, like a bit of a cutout or a depression. So the sheep couldn't see us real well, but from the front of the face, looking at the face, you could see us no problem. So these other hunters come into the valley. There's four of them, two husband and wife couples, two couples. And they're kind of getting ready, set up at camp. And we can glass over there. We see what's going on. After they've been there for a couple hours, they're glassing up at us. It appears like they know that we're there. And so they start walking towards us. And me and Chad are kind of looking at each other like, what's going on here? Like we're the only two people in the valley at that point. The other guys have packed up and left. It turned out there was one other person way down at the end, but we didn't know about him at that time. And there's lots of mountains here. And they're coming right at us. And we're a little bit confused. And we're like, this is interesting. And they keep getting closer and closer. And they're like beelining it to us while we're on the mountain with some sheep. And yep, they start getting to the bottom of the mountain and they start climbing right up to where we are. And I'm like, what is going on here? And I'm not going to lie, I'm starting to get a little frustrated. So I kind of get up out of where we were and I start hiking down the hill and we kind of meet halfway. And I was pretty reasonable at first. I was like, hey guys, what's going on? And they're like, oh, we're just wondering if your hunting partner was in the middle of a stalk back there. And I'm like, nope. We're watching some sheep. And then I was like, I'm a little confused though. I'm like, how does that matter if he's in a stalk or not? Like we're sitting on this piece of ground. We're sitting on top of sheep. Was your intention really to come walking straight through where we were so you could go take a look off the back or maybe even get on the same sheep? Like I was trying to figure it out. And the guy was trying to explain himself, but he wasn't doing a great job. And he was basically like making it clear that, yeah, we were coming right up where you guys were. I forget if he said, you know, we wanted to ask you what your plans were or something like that. And that's when I started to get agitated. And I'll admit, I'm not, you know, I wish I'd have maybe been a bit more calm, but I started to lose my temper at this point. And I'm like, so you saw two hunters sitting on sheep on a hill and your thought process led you to the conclusion that you should walk up the middle of the hill in broad daylight. Now, to put things in context, I'd gotten up at 3:30 in that morning. We got up at 3:30 in the morning, four mornings in a row to get to our spot on the hill in the dark so that when the sun came up, wherever the sheep were, they wouldn't have known or seen us come into our little hidey hole. And I go to him, I got up at 3:30 this morning so I could come to this spot in the dark. And then you blow out my spot by marching up the middle of my hill in the middle of the day. And I looked at him, I'm like, and you thought this was a good idea. I'm like, to me, this just seems like incredibly rude. Anyways, we had some words, some back and forth, and he kind of goes off the hill. And I'm like, listen, for future reference, do not go walking up on people in the middle of a hunt, regardless of if someone is engaged in a stalk. Like, it just felt really disrespectful. Like, I get it. I can't lay claim to a whole mountain. I have no problem with that. But in the same breath, I don't think it's appropriate that you walk right up. Like, if you want to chat, like, they could see my tent. My tent was probably 3/4 of a mile from their tent, down on the flats. Like, it would have took 10 minutes to walk over that night when we were having dinner. Like, if you want to come into camp, you want to sit down, have a chat, hang out, you know what I mean? Like, come over at night. I am more than happy. Let's come up with a game plan. I don't want to step all over each other. There was lots of mountains. There was still decent sheep numbers at that point. Like, let's figure something out. But do not come walking up to me in the middle of the hunt. Anyways, Long story short, what I'd like to hear from you guys is like, what are your feelings on this etiquette? Like, because I was talking with my partner and he's been in several occasions where people scooped him hard on sheep, like would walk right past, or, and there does seem to be varying opinions on what is appropriate etiquette out there. And I'm not always right. Maybe I shouldn't have lost my temper. Maybe it is all right to walk up on people in the middle of the day. I don't know. That just kind of blows my mind. But anyways, would love to hear from you guys either in the comments section or shoot me an email or a DM. And I'm just curious, like, where people stand on this. Like, what is appropriate etiquette in hunting situations? And is there a difference between species? Do you know, like, I feel if you're at a trailhead, or not a trailhead, but you know, lots of times when you're hunting elk or deer, you're kind of at a landing, like the end of a road, and you're sitting there and glassing and you're not right in the mix. Now, if I'm in that situation and you come walking up to me, I think that's fine. That's great. Let's have a chat. There's no animals within 100 yards. You're not impeding my ability to hunt. But when you're literally like sub 100 yards from a group of animals and clearly hiding so they don't see you, to me, you don't walk up to people in that situation. Anyways, that I had to give my head a shake afterwards. And I will say they never walked up to us again. My hunting partner was like, holy shit, that was intense. I'm like, well, you know, someone once said, what's that saying? I do not suffer fools lightly. And the fact is, I don't. Well, now that we've successfully caught all the ranting out of the way and we're probably half an hour deep into the podcast, let's actually get into the purpose of this podcast, which is not to talk about idiots who stomp up hills in the middle of the day. It is to talk about gear. So top of the list, I took my Exo K4. I'm still running the 7200 prototype. Knocked it out of the park. I just got to say again and again, this is my favorite pack. And I will say, on my goat hunts this year, where I had close to a 90 pound pack, and I think I can do better this year, but winter goat hunts are more challenging to pack for, because there's just simply, by the time you add in some crampons, cold weather gear, climbing rope, you know, a heavier stove and all the rest of it, it's a lot. And I wouldn't say some frustrations with the pack, but it would like, I'd start to get some hot spots or it'd start slipping down my back. And I don't think it's really fair to assess a pack, you know, for its overall fit and function at 90 pounds. I think it's important to know how it carries 90, 100, 120 pounds for packouts. But I do think now it's more important to assess your overall experience of the pack with something more realistic, like a 70 pound pack, because at 65 pounds, like it was a dream. And as I was eating my food and it got a little bit lighter, it was just, I can't say enough good things about this pack. Now, the only issue that I did have, and I did have a prototype pack, there was one area of stitching that started to let go. And I talked with Exo after this, and there was a significant change in that particular area between the prototype and the final. Because when I sent a picture to Mark and I was like, hey, this little area let go, can I send it in for repair? Right away, he's like, oh, that's your prototype pack, isn't it? And I'm like, yeah, it is. He's like, okay, that part got changed. Send me yours because I want to see what happened, but we're going to ship you out one of the final production packs because it doesn't have that particular weakness. So that, just more points for those guys. Do you know what I mean? Like, it was so funny that a weakness in the pack that took me a year of beating the shit out of it to notice, they had already found during their testing process and fixed before the final versions went to market. So K4 knocked it out of the park. Up next, we have the Argali Owyhee one-person shelter. Now, this is a trekking pole shelter that's two pieces. It is a floorless shelter sill poly tarp coupled with an inner mesh liner with a sill poly ground sheet attached to it. And you basically clip these together and mount it with a trekking pole. I will have a video next week coming out reviewing this shelter. right now, this is my my favorite one-person shelter I've ever run. It is sub 2 pounds. It is very roomy inside for a one-person shelter. The biggest learning I had with it when I first started pitching it, I was pitching it tight to the ground, and that kind of minimized the headroom a little bit. And there was a couple condensation issues on the inside, which you're always going to get, especially with single wall shelters. But then I moved camp one day and I figured out a way to set it up. So there was like a 3-inch gap on the bottom, basically elevating the tent, elevating the shelter off the ground by like 3 inches by lengthening the guy lines and then the guy lines that hold the pegs in and extending the trekking pole in the middle. And that really changed my experience in that shelter. It gave me more headroom. It let breeze in from underneath. The condensation issues were solved. We were in decent, you know, hard weather conditions. We had one day where it hailed significantly, probably 30 kilometer an hour winds. And I kept my tent elevated. I didn't do anything special. I didn't tie in to any rocks. I didn't build any little buffers. I did nothing. And the shelter didn't budge. So it held up to weather extremely well. I don't think I would recommend it for, I don't want to say that. Here's what I want to say. I haven't tested it through intense enough conditions to say this would be my like go-to late season shelter where you're going to see full-blown storm conditions. That would, you know, I'd still want to test it during those. But I would say on a scale of 5, the weather we saw was like a 3. Like good solid weather where you're sitting in your tent and you're like, oh yeah, she's going. Like tent's blowing around and it's not, I kind of like those situations, but you definitely know you're in weather. Held up perfectly fine. There was room in the vestibule for all my gear and my pack, and I could still get in and out with it like that. So like I say, I will get into more depth on it, and the price is very reasonable. And here's the deal. I used the mesh insert because I had it. I thought bugs were pretty intense for the first half of the trip, and I thought I would need it to keep them out. But I actually, it has a crescent moon zip on it. So it really, it zips around the entire perimeter of or circumference of the shelter. So when it opens, the whole wall comes down, and it's like, it's not even, there's not even an insert in there except for against the far walls, which is nice because it does serve as a bit of a barrier for condensation. And when you rub your shoulders on the mesh, it kind of keeps you from rubbing into the walls, although the walls stayed unbelievably dry. And I would just like to digress as well and say this is the first Sil Poly shelter I've run. One of the fundamental differences between Sil Poly and Sil Nylon is that Sil Poly doesn't sag and stretch when wet, and Sil Nylon, as everyone knows, does. And I'm a Sil Poly convert. I'm not going to say I'm never going to run anything Sil Nylon, but I don't understand. Maybe it's just cheaper, but Sil Poly is clearly a superior fabric to Sil Nylon. So I would love to start seeing more Sil Poly shelters. I think there's a few companies out there, but nothing like Sil Nylon. So back to the mesh insert. I had it. I thought it would keep the bugs out, or I thought I would need it to keep the bugs out. But it turns out I never had any bugs in the tent, and I didn't even leave it zipped up. The front zipper was more than enough to keep them out. Even with it elevated, I thought they would have been coming in from underneath because there was these little tiny red flies and other like kind of no-see-em like dudes, and zero bugs inside the tent, even leaving the mesh liner down. So it was 2 pounds with the mesh liner. I think you could easily take this tent. I'm bringing it elk hunting, and I will not be bringing, I'll bring the mesh liner, but I'm just going to leave it in the truck. So I'll literally be hiking around with a 1 pound floorless shelter. And that's what I'm going to do for my elk hunt because I want to stay super light. I'm going back to like bivy mode elk hunting, and I love this thing, man. I'll get into more details, but Brad and the team at Argali just knocked this thing out of the park. off. The rest of the sleep system is as follows. I had a Big Agnes Zoom wide long sleeping pad, and an Enlightened Equipment Enigma down quilt. And that's a 20 degree down quilt, and it weighs 22.5 ounces. And I believe the Big Agnes sleeping pad weighs, it's either 20 or 22 ounces. It's over a pound, but I believe it's under a pound and a half. It's their newer pad. It's a little bit thinner than the Big Agnes Q-Core, which has been replaced by the Rapide SL, which is 3.5 in the middle and I think 3.75 or 4.25 on the two outer baffles. And the Zoom is 3 inches wide, the whole thing across. The Zoom did very well for me. It was a comfortable pad. I slept on it. You do need to put a couple of breaths of fresh air into it kinda every day. And I don't know, this is something that I've run into with a lot of sleeping pads. So I don't know if there's just like very, very slow leaks in a lot of pads, like through the seams or through, you know, where the air stopper is, the plug. Because it wasn't like it ever deflated, not even anywhere close. But let's say you got to camp and, or let's say it was full in the morning. You get to camp, you set up camp, you fill it up in the morning, or at noon you fill up your pad. Because I did notice I've always wondered if this has something to do with air pressure, because I feel like when I fill the pad up when it's hot at noon or two, and then by the time I go to bed, it's 8 or 9 o'clock at night, temperature has dropped significantly. Like the temps would fall off a cliff out there around 7 o'clock. It would get cold, like puffy jacket cold. Then when I go to bed and I feel my pad, it's lost that kind of firm bounce. And I literally open it up. I put two small breaths in it and it pops right back up to full firmness. And I've always wondered, is this a function of pressure or is it a function of actually leaking? Now the data point that leads me to believe it's not just from pressure is that if it was, when you put those two breaths in, when the pad warmed back up, it would almost be over full now. And that doesn't seem to happen. It seems like at least once a night, maybe once every other night, you got to put those two breaths in it to get that last little pop to it. So that was a note. I've been thinking that I might exchange it. Big Agnes is great. I had a Q-Core that leaked. And they make you cut out the label, like the part where the brand name of the company is, you know, printed on the pad. You have to cut that out and show them a picture of it. That proves you've destroyed the sleeping pad, and they just send you a new one. So you don't even have to send the old one back. It's pretty great. But for a pad, I think the Zoom is 8 ounces, maybe 6 ounces less than the Rapide SL and the Q-Core SLX. So it's a significant weight savings. It is a slightly more minimalist pad, but I will say for a hunt like this, it's worth it. Like to save almost half a pound, I slept great. I probably slept better this hunt than I have on any other hunt. It's a combination of things, but the other thing is I only took one pillow on this hunt. I usually bring two pillows and like Velcro them together so I can sleep on my sides. And then actually halfway through the hunt, I stopped using the pillow altogether. So I think I'm going to stop bringing pillows. I usually always bring ultralight rain gear, the Sitka Dew Point system, and a puffy jacket on almost all hunts. Because especially here in BC, you could easily drop down to 10 or 12 degrees at night. And when you're sitting outside, that's kind of puffy jacket weather, maybe 6 or 8 degrees. But and you always should have rain gear in British Columbia because it could rain on you at any time. And that Sitka Dew Point stuff is unbelievably light. So it's like you're almost an idiot to not bring something like that. By the way, if you're on a budget, go look at Frog Togs. They have this like $30 rain gear that weighs next to nothing. And it's not going to last you 10 years, but it will get you through. And it's the perfect kind of backup rain gear. Anyways, I put all those clothes in a dry bag and about halfway, and I was trying to layer that with the pillow for the first half of the hunt. And then I realized if I just kind of rolled that dry bag in the correct way, it was the perfect pillow. So I've kind of come full circle from never using a pillow to using a pillow to using two pillows, all the way back to not using a pillow now. And that was just basically weight savings. I'd never weighed those two pillows. And when I weighed them together, they weighed almost half a pound. And I was like, okay, I don't mind taking a couple luxury items, but bringing a half a pound of pillows seems a little bit excessive. So for my elk hunt, I will not be bringing that pillow, and I will just be using some clothes stuffed into a dry bag. Now, the last note of shelter items that I brought was my Z-Pax Dyneema 7x9 flat tarp. Use that thing, definitely not every day, but probably at least half of the days. We had some really intense weather the second half of the hunt, and we would be sitting up on the hill for over 16 hours because we would leave camp. We'd wake up at 3:30, leave camp by 4, and we'd be hiked up in the mountains by 5 a.m., and we wouldn't come down until 7 or 8 at night. So a good 14, 15 hours up there. And it got to the point where at the first couple of days, I was like waiting for the rain to start. And then it became apparent that it was going to be rainy and windy all day, off and on. So as soon as I got to my spot in the morning, we'd split up by the end of the, you know, second or third day hunting this spot so we could have different vantage points. As soon as I got to my spot in the dark, the first thing I did was drop my pack and set up my tarp because the wind was down in the morning. Made it easier to set up. I used a single trekking pole style. What I will do is I'm going to post a picture on my Instagram of how I set this tarp up. So if you're curious how I set my tarp up on the mountain, let me know. If you're curious what this looks like, go to my Instagram. You'll see that picture and you'll see how I set my tarp up. But I basically have Dyneema cord permanently attached to line locks on my tarp, and I peg it down at the back, put a trekking pole in the middle at the front, and then peg down the other two corners with like maybe 6 to 8 feet of cord, leaving it nice and elevated, but providing a really good shelter from the rain. So highly recommend that. The tarp itself weighs 5 ounces. There's probably 2 ounces, maybe 3 ounces of pegs and guy lines that you got to bring with you. Okay, let's move on to clothing. Now, I was going to wear a Lululemon or a Kuhl base layer, that's K-U-H-L, and I kind of chickened out at the end, and I went back to the Core lightweight hoodie. It was an archery hunt. I tried to dye one of those shirts a camo pattern, and I failed dramatically. As soon as I put it in the wash, it just came out like a shade darker, and the whole camo pattern I'd kind of printed on there ended up running off, and I just didn't feel comfortable archery hunting without camo. I recognize this is irrational. There are killers everywhere who are wearing solids and not spooking animals. I recognize it's not how they see, but it was just psychologically, I was just like, I want that camo. Now, that being said, I'm in discussions with Stone Glacier right now to be testing a good chunk of their apparel. And so if we can work things out in time and get the gear here in time, I should be archery elk hunting in some Stone Glacier solids. So I'm going to have to get over it. But anyways, for a top base layer, I ran the Sitka Core lightweight hoodie. Now that I'm down in size, a extra large tall fit extremely well. Up next, Lululemon boxers. Everybody knows how I feel about Lululemon boxers. I did have a negative experience where a 3-month-old pair ripped on me. I thought that was kind of ridiculous. I emailed them. They said they weren't warranty replacing them, but they sent me a gift certificate for $30, which I was like, well, that sounds like a warranty replacement to me, but I think they just didn't want to take responsibility for it. So I'm still kind of, but it was the, I bought 6 pairs and it was the only pair that did that. And the other pairs are holding up. Now, for example, on a hunt like this, I only take 1 pair of socks and 1 pair of underwear, the ones I'm wearing. I never change in the entire 12 days. I was ruthless with my pack this year. No extra shirts, no extra socks and underwear, no extra nothing. And the fact that you can wear a pair of boxers 12 days in a row and they don't start to degrade at all says a lot. You know, try and do that with most merino boxers and you're going to blow them out because they need to be washed and lofted back up in order to kind of refresh the material. So those worked out great. Sitka Ascent Pant. This is my favorite pair of hunting pants. It's going to take a lot to dethrone these. They have knee pads. They have a nice athletic fit. I still have to size up to a 38. I'm normally a 36 waist, but with these pants, I have to run a 38 so I have enough room in the thigh, and which means the waist is a little big, but I wear an arcade stretchy belt, and I don't even really notice it once they're on. But it is one note of fitment that I want to share. I've gone back and forth between heavy pants that take longer to get wet and lighter pants that get wet faster but dry faster. And for my style of hunting and my body type, I prefer the lighter pants. I tend to run hot, so I would rather get a little wetter but be a little cooler. I wore a Sitka ball cap almost the entire hunt. I really like that ball cap. I ran Schnee's Beartooth boots, my favorite all-purpose boots on the planet. Obviously, I can't wear them for extreme, you know, sheep hunts. And where we were wasn't crazy for hiking in shale and rock and cliffs and stuff. So these boots were perfect. I can't recommend those boots enough. Darn Tough Overcalf socks. Only had one pair. Wore them the entire time. They didn't degrade in any way, shape, or form. They held up. I did take them off every night and just kind of left them in the top of my boots in the tent so they could air out a little bit. Other than that, that's the other note I want to make. I sleep in all my clothes every night. And some people don't like doing this. And here's the biggest reason. It used to be because I would use my sleeping bag to dry out my system. So if I got wet during the day, I would get in my sleeping bag at night, close it up. It's a quilt actually, but close the quilt up. And, you know, through the process of moisture evacuation, my body heat would push all the moisture out and I would wake up bone dry. So that's why I started doing it. But when I'm on, I went to bed basically bone dry every night. So the question is, well, why would you still sleep in your clothes? Funny reason, it's easier to get up in the morning. I found myself when you strip down to your boxers, maybe it's a couple of percentage points more comfortable to sleep at night, but there's always a slight delay in the morning. You're like, it's cold. I don't want to get out of my quilt. And then depending on where you put your pants and stuff, maybe you put them in the foot of your bag, but maybe you left them out. Maybe they're kind of damp with condensation. Who knows? But there's always this moment of hesitation in the morning, which sometimes can stretch out 5, 10, 15 minutes. When I'm fully clothed, that moment of hesitation is gone. The alarm goes off. It's time to hunt. Quilt gets opened. I hop out of bed. There's no worrying if it's cold or wet or anything like that. So it's more of a little mental hack to make getting up in the morning less frictious. Already mentioned the arcade stretchy belt. Love that thing. In fact, I lost one while I was in Europe this year. I left it hanging in the closet of a hotel and I bought a brand new one because it is the single best hunting belt I've ever had. It's phenomenal. Ran the Argali trekking poles. I will have a review on those up next week. There's some good, some bad. Overall, they're very well constructed. If you've purchased a pair, you have nothing to worry about, but there's definitely a couple of points of feedback I have that are just not perfect in my opinion. And ran the Ultra Gators from, I forget what they're called. I think he has two kinds. One's called the Silverback and one's called something else. I can't remember. These are still not commercially available, so you can't buy them yet. They should be available early next year, but I really like these gaiters. Now, up after that is so that was basically my system that I was wearing all the time. Now, here's what I packed. The Sitka Ambient hoodie, which for me is still one of the most versatile pieces I own. It is more breathable than the Core Heavyweight hoodie, but it's warmer than the Core Heavyweight hoodie. It dries faster. I know it's expensive as hell, guys. but it, I can't recommend this piece more than I do. In addition to that, I took the Sitka Kelvin Aerolite puffy jacket. Big fan of synthetic puffy layers and a real big fan of that Aerolite material. I think it's within 10 to 15% of the warmth and weight of a down piece, but you don't have the vulnerability of getting down wet. So I think it's a much more robust piece. I took the Dewpoint jacket and pants. Wore them each a little bit. The jacket more than the pants, but they're extremely lightweight. I think the jacket is 14 ounces and the pants are 12 ounces. So 26 ounces. So you have a pound and 10 ounces. So just over a pound and a half for the two. They're always in my pack on no matter what hunt I go on. I recommend those highly. And for gloves, the only thing I took was a pair of Mechanics gloves. You know, the M-E-C-H-A-N-I-X, Mechanics. They're like a brand name of gloves. I have found, you know, finding great gloves incredibly challenging. If they're thin enough to still provide dexterity, they seem to, you know, fall apart within a couple of hunts. And if they're thicker than that, they make my hands sweat and I can't feel anything. So I'm constantly taking them on and off. And then I'm like, well, there's no point. Let's just leave them off. And then another thing with gloves is once they get wet once, unless you get a break in the weather, they tend to stay wet. So I just leave them in my pack. Gloves are a frustration. Best solution I've found is Mechanics gloves. They're like $20 and they're a nice blend of thin enough that you can have dexterity and thick enough to provide some protection. I did kind of wish I'd taken my heavier gloves. There was two or three mornings where we were glassing that it was like pretty chilly and some thicker gloves would have been nice, but you gotta draw the line somewhere. I also brought my Sitka Jetstream beanie, which I normally sleep in, but I left my ambient hoodie on most nights and I just use the hood from the hoodie. So I actually never put the beanie on once. Optics, Zeiss Victory Harpyon 95 millimeter, AKA the Eye of God. Thing is a tank, man, but man, does stuff look good through it. And I knew we were going to potentially be in the situation where we would need to age a sheep based on ring count, and I wanted all the help I could get. Now, interesting to note, I do have a Kawa 66. I've already bought it. It's sitting at my post box in the States waiting to get picked up. I'm getting it tomorrow morning. I will start reviewing that immediately. Would I have taken that if it had shown up in time? Probably. The Zeiss is just so big, man, that it's a lot. I think if you were partner hunting where you could get away with one spotter between the two of you, there would maybe be an argument to take it. But I also don't know how realistic that is. I like looking through my spotter a lot, and I don't know if I want to be in a situation where I have to share my spotter. But yeah, not much to say about that. I recommend it highly for optical quality. I do not recommend it much at all for pain in the ass because, you know, it's almost 6 pounds, maybe more than 6 pounds. I think I have it written down here as 81 ounces. What's 6 times 16? It would be 60 plus 36 would be 96. So no, it's 5 pounds, right on the money, 5 pounds and 1 ounce. It's a lot. In addition to that, I had my Swarovski NL Pure 12x42. I love that glass. Favorite binos, hands down, enough said. I have my Alaska Guide Creations binocular case. I actually just had to drop that off to get fixed at a seamstress. Small note for you guys. Any of your heavy grade stuff you're looking to get fixed with Cordura, like backpacks, bino cases, gaiters, you can't take them into regular seamstresses because they don't have the equipment to fix stuff like that. What you want to look for is a luggage repair or shoe repair place. And lots of times they will note that they do both luggage and shoes. That's the best bet. I took it to one. The guy wanted $125 to fix it. He's like, I'll give you a 5-year guarantee. I'm like, bro, it's sewing. You know what I mean? Like, no, I don't want a guarantee. And he's like, okay, 95. And I'm like, this is insane. I'm like, no, literally the next day, take it to a place down the street. And they're like, yeah, $20, man. Come get it next week. And I was like, thank you. Like, this is going to take 10 minutes. It's two areas that need to be sewn up that have let go. I am in the process of looking for a bino case. And I'm going to be honest with you. None of the ones currently on the market do exactly what I want a bino case to do without spending a fortune. The only one that I can put together that kind of satisfies my needs is the FHF. And by the time I put all the components on there that I need, it's $600 Canadian. And I'm just like, you can buy a backpack for $600 Canadian. Like, I'm sorry, but this is insane. Like, it's too much. I just can't in good conscience pull the trigger. And I was like, oh, I'll do a review on it and maybe raffle it off or give it away after, and that'll justify the cost. But then I'm like, am I really going to tell people to go spend $600 on a bino harness? Like, that just seems absurd. And here's my struggle. Obviously, I need a place to carry my binos. There's problem one. Number two, I need a rangefinder. Okay, that's not that big a deal. Number three, I'd like a place to put my bear spray. Okay, that seems to be a fairly solvable problem on a few of the systems. The problem is the phone. So I run an iPhone 12 Pro Max. And when you put the phone scope case on that or any other case, it ends up being about like 3.1, 3.2 inches wide and 6.25 inches long. And none of the other bino harness equipment manufacturers have an additional case that's that big, which is insane to me. Everyone runs a large phone. How do we not have, like, Marsupial has a case, and I asked, and I'm like, does it fit? And they're like, no, it doesn't fit, you know, large phones. I'm like, everybody runs a large phone. How do you not have a case that goes on your bino harness that holds a large phone? Like, I'm in and out of my phone all the time. I'm either phone scoping, looking at maps. I want it handy on my chest. I don't like hiking it with it in my pockets. It's too big. I worry about it getting banged on stuff. My Alaska Guy Creations harness is perfect because it has a stretchy pocket right on the top of the lid. And it's tight. It's very tight. So when I slide my phone in there, I've been running this harness for 5 years. I've been carrying my phone in there for 5 years. It has never even remotely slipped one time. It's not coming out of there. So not only does Alaska Guide Creation solve that problem, they solve it for free. Whereas everybody else wants you to spend another $100 on another pocket that's going to, you know, take up more room. Talk to the guys at Catamount. They have a cash pocket. Theirs isn't big enough. I already mentioned Marsupial. Theirs isn't big enough. T&K doesn't have one that's big enough. So I'm in this situation where I'm just going to keep using my old Alaska Guide Creations. If I need to get it sewn up, I will. But note to bino harness manufacturers out there, why do you not? And I will say this, the navigation pouch that FHF offers is way too bulky. It holds, you can put batteries and an inReach and a phone, and it's like this big gigantic thing. And I'm like, okay, well, that will work. But that's not what I'm looking for either. I want a zipped up pocket or a sleeve that I can leave open that attaches to my bino harness that I can with ease slide my phone in and out of that won't get in the way when the bino lid is open. That's all I want. I don't know why that's such a difficult thing to make. And it shocks me that it's not something that's so clearly needed that somebody hasn't developed it already. So there you go. There's my rant on bino harnesses. So for now, I'm sticking with my Alaska Guide Creations. I took a Leupold RX1200 TBR rangefinder for a budget rangefinder. I think it's a great option. I brought some lens cloths, and I like bringing the Zeiss wipes. So they're like individually wrapped lens wipes that have moisture on them. The reason that these are really nice is that when your binoculars are wet, when you use a dry lens cloth, you tend to just move the moisture around because they're not very absorbent. When you use an alcohol-based wipe, it actually evaporates that moisture off of the lenses, and it's way more effective. So I really like having Zeiss wipes. I learned that goat hunting. Once all my stuff got wet in the winter, nothing would clean the moisture off of the binoculars and the spotting scope, it just kept moving the moisture around. But if I used a lens wipe and then just kind of let the air sit on it for, you know, 3 to 5 seconds, it would dry it completely. For a tripod, I took the Tricer BC with the Tricer pan head. It was a decent system. I'm not going to go into it in depth because I have a review coming out of this one. The Asiac equipment tripod just showed up, and I think a really interesting video is going to be Tricer versus Asiac. I think that's going to be more beneficial for you guys than just reviewing the Tricer and then a month later just reviewing the Asiac. I think comparison reviews are very helpful. I will say there are some things about the Tricer that frustrate me to the point where I wouldn't recommend anybody goes and runs out and buys it. Listen, it works. There's nothing fundamentally wrong with it. It's not broken, but there are definitely some things that bug me about it. So I will share those in a video soon. For digiscoping, I used a phone scope. I did a bit of rant before I get in. Everybody's all about MagView and Olens, and the amount of DMs I get with people like, do you know how to make the MagView work, or my Olens won't line up? And I'm like, no, I've never used either. And the fact that this many people can't get them to work tells me there's something wrong. And the freaking things are hundreds of dollars and a phone scope's like $50. So I was like, I don't understand the need for innovation in that space. I thought the phone scope worked just fine. In fact, my buddy Danny, who has an Instagram account and makes videos with his friends under Backcountry Carnivores, good local boys here from Vancouver. I just watched a story on his where he had the MagView, he had it all set up, and it was proving to be so problematic that he actually ordered a new phone scope, and he's just taking that instead of this like multi-$100 MagView system. So I don't know, take that with a grain of salt, but yeah, I'm a little bit confused. I don't think any of these new systems, because the only people I see really recommending these systems are the people who are paid to recommend it. Guys like Elp Shape, who is working with MagView, and other people who are clearly working with these companies seem to love these things, but I can't find anybody who's not paid to like them, who's evangelically spouting, you know, the highlights of these systems. So for me, phone scope until future notice. Moving on to camera gear, I brought my Sony A1 with a Rode Video Micro, a 24 to 70 mil second generation G Master f/2.8 Sony lens, GoPro Hero 11, an Insta360, and a variety of batteries, mounts, and etc. I won't go crazy in depth on camera gear. Everything worked extremely well. I've been running this system for multiple years. I know it inside and out. I know exactly what I need and exactly what I don't. Worked great. I will be putting together it's going to be a guidebook. It's going to be a guidebook for solo filming in the backcountry. Not really a book per se, but like maybe a 5-6 page downloadable PDF. I'm going to start working on it now. Probably won't be available until the new year. But if there are elements of filming in the backcountry that you're particularly interested in, drop me a note and I'll make sure that I put my thoughts around those issues in the guidebook. Okay, some miscellaneous stuff that I brought. I bring like a half of a Therm-a-Rest Z-Lite, you know, those foldable closed cell foam sleeping pads. I usually cut one of those in half and I use it for a variety of things. Most often just to sit on. Sometimes I put it under my sleeping pad. Most times I don't. Highly recommend that. Really lightweight. Also, I found it was very useful for helping to strap my bow to the back of my pack. So I would lay my pack down flat. I would put my bow on the back of my pack. Then I would fold up the Z-Rest and put it kind of between the riser and the sight. And then when I strapped things down, it was compressing the pad, not the bow. And then you had all this padding between the straps and the bow, and it actually held the bow way more solid than just directly across the bow, because it was kind of compressing the whole riser, not just two thin points on the riser where there's still some ability for it to rotate. That worked really well. I have lip balm down here. What I should have, I have this little sun stick at home. It's like sunscreen that comes in a thick stick like chapstick. but bigger, but like, you know, maybe an inch in diameter instead of, you know, 3/8 of an inch or half an inch in diameter. I got sunburnt lips on this trip, which is really weird. My bottom lip got sunburnt and I ended up getting 2 blisters and it was kind of painful. Like, it wasn't the worst thing in the world. I survived, but like, it was annoying 4 or 5 days. So I kept lathering on the chapstick, but it wasn't really helping. So I'm going to bring one of those face sticks with sunscreen next time, because I think having a little bit on your face, you really get the shit beat out of you up at elevation by the sun. And I think it's important to take care of ourselves. I took 2 hunting knives, one from Hut 2 Lifestyle here in BC, another one from Bruce Culberson. Didn't get a chance to use either of them. Caribou Gear carnivore game bags, took 3 of those. Steripen, as always, worked flawlessly. I had a Garmin 66i with Backroad Mapbooks. My only issue with that thing is battery life. If you leave it on all day, it nukes about 3/4 of the battery because it's bigger, it's got a bigger screen, it's doing more stuff in the background. And I wish there was like an in-reach mode. Like, I wish you could just shut every, I don't want to see the map, I don't want to see anything. I want to shut everything off but the in-reach. Well, that begs the question, why don't you just take an in-reach mini? Because the Garmin 66i provides backup navigational functionality and real functionality, like an actual screen you can see, actual maps that are worthwhile and helpful. And after the issue with my phone last year, I always carry some type of backup navigation. I keep it somewhere else on my system so that if something happens to my phone, I still have the 66i as backup. And the solution there I found is just keep it shut off. Wake up in the morning, in-reach everybody you need to, and then just shut the thing off and turn it on as you need to. And you do that, battery lasts forever. iPhone 12 Pro Max. Yep, it's an iPhone, worked great. My luxury item, my GSI Microlite 500ml coffee mug. Love this thing, man. Now for battery power, I took the 20,000 milliamp hour Anker 525 battery cell, and I also brought a 21 watt Anker solar charger. And my buddy had a Goal Zero solar charger. His sucked balls. We were putting them side by side, and my Anker was charging things 3 to 4 times faster. Like, it was wild. Even in low light conditions, his wouldn't charge anything, and I was still getting, you know, 2 to 3% every 10 minutes on my phone, even in heavily overcast conditions. So highly recommend that Anker 21 watt solar charger. You can buy it on Amazon. It's like $60. I'm really not impressed with all these brand name battery and solar products. I think they're all white label manufactured at the same places overseas, because it seems like when I just buy the Anker stuff, it just kicks the shit out of everything else. Brought a 1 liter Nalgene, of course. Now, my stove. I ended up going with a Jetboil Minimo. It's the lightest stove I own, and I ended up having regulator issues on it. So this is the second equipment failure I've had with a Jetboil in probably 3-4 years, which doesn't sound like a lot, but Jetboil only has a 1 year limited warranty on their equipment, which I found shocking. That really says a lot to me, that they're only willing to stand behind their stuff for a year. Like, it's a stove. You're only using it for a couple months out of the year anyways. And when I inquired about the failed regulator, I could still get it to work, but it was unreliable. Sometimes halfway through a cook, it would just shut off. And if I took it apart and put it back together, I could get it to fire up again. But it was like, I don't have enough confidence in it to take it on another hunt, because I feel like at this point, it could just die at any time. So, it failed. Hit them up, told them what happened. They said it's out of warranty and the replacement part is $75. The stove itself was like $160. So I decided, I already have my MSR reactor, which is only 2 or 3 ounces more, way more reliable, better in cold weather, just a superior system overall. You can take the larger fuel canisters. It's just way better. So what I really want was like an ultralight cook system. And I, before Mine failed. My buddy had the Jet Light Solo, the Jet Boil Solo, which they don't make anymore. They make the Jet Boil Zip, which is like a 12-ounce stove, I think, that boils. It has a 500-milliliter container. So I was looking at that, but then the regulator went, and I'm like, I'm done with Jet Boil. Two failures in less than 3 or 4 years. I'm done. I'm not supporting your company anymore, especially when you don't fix them for free. I had to pay to get both of those things fixed. The piezo lighter went on one of them, and now the regulator went on a second one, both the Minimo editions. So I actually bought a MSR pocket rocket, and then I got a 550-milliliter titanium, essentially looks like a coffee cup with a lid, but it's a small pot, and it's just large enough to fit a 100-gram fuel canister. And so literally, I think my entire cook system without the fuel weighs something like 6 ounces, like 2 ounces for the pocket rocket and 3 ounces for the coffee cup, or maybe even less. It might be 4 ounces altogether. Like, it is an insanely lightweight system. So that's what I'm going to be taking on Elk. I had a 6-liter MSR Dromlight bladder, which I used. I really like that a lot. Took the Peaks headlamp. I was very happy with it. I used the red almost every morning for 5 or 6 days in a row. Now, food. I'm going to do a video completely just about the food, and I had a couple different things that I took. Like, I basically had two days, day A and day B, with a couple different snacks, but that were different between the two. But basically, I had 2 pounds of food. It was 3,300 calories. Probably had 200 grams of protein. Maybe, I want to say 100, 150 grams of fat, and then the rest were carbs. But I had, for breakfast, I had a make your own 2 scoops of protein, a little bit of cereal, a little bit of dried cranberries in a vacuum sealed bag, put water on that, delicious cereal. Brought four sleeves of Via Starbucks instant coffee, thing of trail mix, a Green Belly Meals for lunch, a couple packs of Chewies, a sausage, Peak Refuel for dinner, a protein bar, had extra MCT oil powder in the Peak Refuel dinner. And I also brought some kind of keto coffee creamer and keto hot chocolate. That's really just like 150 calories of fat that tastes sweet that you put in your hot beverages. And that was super enjoyable. I really liked having those. I will be taking those all the time. Having a cup of hot chocolate before bed is delicious. Helps me sleep and gets you an extra 150 calories of fat for a very minor weight penalty. All right, it's 7:15 in the morning now. I can hear my kid is awake upstairs. I got to run up and make her breakfast. So we're going to tie that in a knot right here. If I went over anything too fast, if you have any specific questions, let me know. I'm going to be posting this gear list on Mindful Reviews later today. So if you want to see it and you're a member, fantastic. If not, I recommend joining. But whether you're a member or not, if you have any specific questions, place it in the comments below on the YouTube video or shoot me an email, jay@mindfulhunter.com, DM on Instagram @mindful_hunter. I greatly appreciate the support. If you can like, share, comment, subscribe, do anything to help push this out to more people, it is always greatly appreciated. And until next time, thanks for tuning in.